When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, bookcasers. Whether you be in your living room, your bedroom, your dining room, your den, we welcome you to another edition of The Bookcase with Kate and Charlie. I'm the Charlie part.
I'm the Kate part, and that's the best part about a bookcase podcast is you can have a bookcase literally any room in your house. You just got to carry us with you. Isn't that nice?
Basement, garage, in the kitchen.
Lanai, portico. I mean, you know, we can come up with this many, you know, I don't know how many more we got.
We have a book for you today that I think you will find interesting. We have avoided politics in this podcast for obvious reasons. But this is Carlos Losada, who is a writer for the New York Times, who's written something called The Washington Book, How to Read Politics and Politicians. He reads all these books. He reads the tell-alls. He reads the campaign biographies. He reads the memoirs of former presidents. He reads it all. And he doesn't like the phrase necessarily, but one of the things is he reads these things so you don't have to. He disdains these books, but he finds them valuable in some ways.
I loved this book. It's in some ways, it's a survey of political writing from Tocqueville to Trump and everything in between. You know, and he also reads all the Senate commission reports and the intelligence reports that come out after the commission hearings of the whatever. He reads it all. I think this gives him a unique perspective, not just into Washington and politics and history, but I think it also gives him a unique perspective into nonfiction in this country and the state of nonfiction. Some of it is pretty sensationalistic and has a lot of exclamation points and really wants, you know, to yell at you. And I really like his writing because it made me feel calmer in some ways about the state of discourse in this country.
In one of the reviews of the book, which he says was a complimentary review, it was mentioned that he is a masochist, even further than that. What kind of masochism was it, Kate?
It was a transcendent masochism. I love that they attach that adjective to masochism. It's amazing.
Well, some of these books, these politicians' books, are really, really boring. And as he says, one of their goals is to use as many words as possible and say as little as possible in these books. And he finds them guilty of that. But he says you can glean little tidbits about the politician that will give you a good indication of what they're about. And he, as I say, he reads the book, so you don't have to. Michael Kinsley, one of the wonderful writers in Washington, once apparently put in some candidate's book, I don't know whose it was, put a promissory note that if you found this in the book, he would send you $5. And nobody took him up on it. People may buy the books, but they don't read them. Carlos Losada does. And bless his heart for going through that transcendent masochism. But as I say, he gets little tidbits, little things that he finds are illustrative of the politician or the Washington writer's character.
Yeah, he reads the footnotes. He reads the acknowledgments. He reads for historical accuracy. He reads the lines. He reads between the lines. I think at one point he said if he can, he reads his books three times. So Carlos Losada is very dedicated to his unique craft. And again, we thought that it would be a great conversation because it would be a way to talk about not just political writing, but also just sort of the state of political discourse in this country.
I was just saying, it is a good conversation. He's a good conversationalist. And so here is our conversation with Carlos Losada. Carlos Losada, it is great to have you in the bookcase and a very interesting, The Washington Book. We have strived to keep this podcast exempt from political books. Why anger half the country? But your book is certainly an exception to that because it does seem that you are able to disdain all political books, but at the same time, find great value in them. How do you pull that off?
The assumption behind that reaction is that these books are bad. They're boring. They're ghostwritten. They're propaganda. But I'm a real believer in Washington books. I find them incredibly useful. And by the way, I define Washington books very broadly. It's sort of memoirs, it's history, but it's also, you know, special counsel investigations, commission reports, all the kind of ritual documentation of Washington. And the reason I find them useful is because, particularly, say, with political memoirs, you know, even when politicians are striving to present themselves in the most benign or favorable light, as they do in these books, when they sanitize their lives and their records, they still find ways to reveal themselves. They show us their fears, their insecurities. They sort of show us who they are, something about their beliefs and their character. It's rarely, for me at least, it's rarely the sort of super sexy, newsy tidbits, you know, the five takeaways from so-and-so's memoir. It's a recurring little tick that they have that they can't get away from. It's a throwaway comment here. It's something in the acknowledgement section of a book, but it's in there. It's in there. And so my sort of self-imposed job is to try to find those moments in these books and hold them up to the light and hold them to account. That's my way of doing journalism.
It feels as if, and I don't know if it's a unique position or if we've always been in this position, but when I worked in the bookstore and I went into the nonfiction section, it felt like both sides were yelling at each other. Lots of exclamation points in the title. And as you point out, lots of apocalypse predicted from both sides. Have we spent so much time seeking out echo chambers for our point of view that nonfiction now has gone to a point of no return?
I think there's a lot of nonfiction that doesn't do what you're talking about. It's just that the nonfiction that sells the most and that gets the most attention is often the nonfiction that does engage in that kind of partisan warfare. And to me, it's not that sort of I'm more or less persuaded by this partisan warrior versus that partisan warrior. It's just that books whose contents are so entirely predictable just aren't interesting to me. Even if I sympathize with, you know, with the particular point of view that's expressed, it's not just book authors, often columnists. You know, I'll point the finger at my own world. The columnists that I tend to come back to are the ones whose views on particular subjects I cannot reliably predict.
Where is the line in the sand, do you think? Or is there a line in the sand? And do you read differently when nonfiction becomes propaganda or more of an op-ed piece?
You know, even propaganda is revealing. Propaganda is useful because it tells you something about how that author, that writer, that voice wishes to be perceived, right? Mm-hmm. And that is informative, right? It also tells you what he thinks of you and me, the reader, right? It tells you kind of through the stories that they share, through the vantage points that they privilege, you learn not just kind of how they see themselves, but how they see us, the audience.
There are three subsets in this genre, in my mind. There are the books written by politicians who want you to read them and therefore believe in their aspirations for higher office. There's the second subset of the aides that you mentioned, of the people who are close to power, mm-hmm. who write their observations over that period of time. And you do learn something about the people that they are writing about. And then there's the third category of presidents, and I have read an awful lot of these, who write books after their presidency and try to tell you what they did mm-hmm. and try to justify and make you sympathetic to what they did. I was very interested that you write about Barack Obama's book, A Promised Land, the second volume of which we are still waiting for. But you say he was writing it as history, but history that justified what he did. And I thought, I wonder what Carlos would think of Churchill's books on the Second World War, if he was doing the same thing in that instance of justifying, while writing a history, trying to justify what he had done. And then I thought back to U.S. Grant, I think, who it's generally agreed upon wrote the best presidential memoir ever. How do you differentiate those categories?
The presidential memoir category is really interesting, in part because presidents often write multiple books. And I find that my law of presidential memoir is that the more distant the book is from that person's time in office, the better it is. Whether before or after, right?
You know,
like I think Obama's best book is always going to be Dreams from My Father, no matter what he continues writing in the future. Audacity of Hope was just kind of a standard campaign-y book. And A Promised Land, which I appreciated, was trying to be multiple things, right? It was trying to sort of, you know, be that blow by blow history of his presidency,
right.
But also kind of like, well, yeah, people complained about this or that, but I think I pretty much did it right. And so Jimmy Carter,
yep.
Same way, right? Jimmy Carter's, you know, has written many, many books. Maybe four or five of them are kind of straight up kind of memoir type books. The least appealing to me was Keeping Faith, his White House memoir that came out a year or two after his presidency. His best, I think, is a book he wrote at least 20 years later, which was called An Hour Before Daylight,
yeah.
Which was a memoir of him growing up on his dad's farm in Georgia during the Depression. It's just a lovely, lovely memoir. And so I'm often interested in books by presidents that don't deal with their presidency.
Huh.
And that's what, in part, what makes Grant's so good, right? Like,
yes.
Grant's is considered the gold standard of presidential memoirs, except it's not a presidential memoir.
Exactly.
It's a memoir of the Civil War, of the Mexican-American War, of his experiences at West Point. You know, those are all books by presidents that are quite a remove from their presidency.
Do you find there a general, like, could you pick up a book about a politician and not know where they were, but tell through their writing style where they are in their political life? I guess what I'm asking is there a cycle of idealism, idealism, justification, cynicism, cynicism? Like, is there a life cycle to politicians' writing?
That's a great question. You'd have to sort of see, especially you have to look at the politicians who have sort of multiple books in them. Or you're right, maybe even if it's just one, you can just based on that book, you can see sort of where they are. You know, I think where you could tell right away, if a book is super guarded, right? If it's full of, you know, faith and apple pie and doffs of the cap to the, you know, to our brave men and women in uniform. Like it's almost definitely someone who's campaigning, who's in the middle of a presidential or some other kind of political campaign. That genre, the like sort of book you have to put out during a campaign, is probably among the least inspiring of the political memoirs. And many of them even admit it. You know, I think George H.W. Bush, when he was running for president, so it was the 88 campaign. I can't remember if the book came out in 87 or but thereabouts, sort of book, this book called, I think all the titles are super generic. It was something like Looking Forward or something like that.
Well, you write about DeSantis's book, which I think is a running for president book. Cautions are thrown to the wind. Less traveled roads are taken. Hammers are dropped. New sheriffs show up in town. Dust settles. Chips eventually fall where they may.
Yes, it is not sort of the most inspiring prose.
Hmm.
And the thing is, though, you know, it's kind of a gamble for the publishing houses too, right? Because they know that one of these persons is going to become the nominee and maybe become president. And that's how you end up with like books by Tim Pawlenty, you know, like Scott Walker, right? Because like there was a moment, remember when Scott Walker was it? Like Scott Walker was going to be the nominee, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, they all have these books. I mean, I think that's why they exist, but to me, those are, I still read them because they're interesting to me. When George H.W. Bush died, and this is, I think, the first chapter in the Washington book, when he died, I went back and looked at sort of all the books that he had published. He hadn't really done a real memoir, right? He did. Mm. He published a book of letters. He published a foreign policy book with Brent Scowcroft. His diary from his time as the U.S. envoy to China in the 70s had been published, right? And that sort of faux campaign memoir, but not like a real, honest, introspective book. And when I read all those other books, I saw that it was there. It was scattered throughout all these other texts. Like there was a great George H.W. memoir that does not exist. But it can be found. But I tried to write it basically in like a 4,000 word essay when he passed away, just drawing from all his other volumes.
Well, that is interesting that you talk about George H.W. because he was a terrific writer. His letters are really interesting. When John Meacham, in his book about Bush, quotes him in letters that he wrote and various things that Bush wrote, he really was a good writer, should have done it. But I think you're absolutely right. Knowing, not that I knew him well, but having spent a good bit of time with him, I do think he probably thought, oh, you know, that's just been done so often. I don't need to do it. And you're right. He probably should have.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Meacham's book, which I read and reviewed, I was working at The Washington Post at the time. You know, certainly maybe Bush felt if I have a top notch biographer, you know, working on my story, I don't have to do that. But I wish he had. No matter how good the biographies are, there's something about about getting that personal voice that I think matters for history. It matters for me. I want to hear it. I wish I'd been able to read that book.
I found myself reading the Washington book, playing a very nerdy English student game, which is, can I find Carlos's thesis in each one of these? Can I find the thesis statement in each one? Mm. And I don't want to give our audience the sense that these aren't compulsively readable. That makes me sound like high school essay. They're compulsively readable and very funny. But I'm just interested if, do you start with a thesis? Is that your process?
No, I don't. Every book that I write about, I read three times. I go through it over and over and over.
Whoa.
Well, I mean, like each time a little faster, right? The first read is the deepest read. The first read is, you know, I wallow in the footnotes. I make tons of, you know, margin comments, you know, underline things, pose questions. The second time I grab a highlighter and I go through it again, but I focus on the sort of sections of the book that clearly struck me the first time where I had the most notes and things. And I read around those parts. I think, okay, why is this interesting to me? Like, what's emerging from here? Mm. And then I read it a third time with my laptop open and call like a subset of the subset, you know, and I dump all those notes and ideas and questions, you know, into the file. And that process takes forever. Then I start reading through that. And that's where I try to find not like what my own thesis is, but like, what's the most interesting idea here that I hadn't thought of before? And that's what I choose to focus on. Mm. Right. So like, I don't go into a reading project, reading experience, kind of like, oh, here's what I want to say about, you know, Kamala Harris or Josh Hawley or Barack Obama. You know, instead, in the course of reading, I decide, oh, okay, I, you know, in a sense that the topic chooses me. Like, there's something that is so obviously compelling that I'm like, well, that's not what I thought I would write about, but I guess that's what I have to write about because it's the thing that I'm always going to remember from this book.
One of the things my father and I talk about is that we don't seem, as the public, to have patience with politicians allowing their point of views to evolve and change. Has that always been the case in this country? And do you see us at some point opening our minds to evolving points of view?
Or do you automatically become a flip-flopper?
Yeah.
And that becomes the ultimate criticism.
Yeah. I remember when people would, you know, show up at was it like Romney rallies holding up flip-flops, you know, or I don't know how long that critique has been around. I don't know if like people showed up, you know, Lincoln rallies with whatever the equivalent of flip-flops were in the mid-19th century. I think that it's useful as humans. We often do and probably should change our minds when we encounter new information, when we learn new things. You know, I think you're seeing some of that in journalism as well. I'm always far more interested in what journalists know than what journalists think. And, you know, with politicians, that's difficult because policy positions seem at least to matter so much. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you give yourself some wiggle room, especially on a very contentious issue like abortion or immigration or, you know, what have you, you know, people pounce right away and be like, well, that's different. I mean, remember, you know, the late, great Tim Russert. You know, that's the thing he did. It's like, well, you said this, but here's the thing you said in 1786, you know, and he would put it on the screen. Right. And it's like, and it was this kind of intense, you know, moment where a politician felt trapped. And I admire leaders who, for real reasons, not for
political purposes.
Exactly. Yeah. Not simply because it's advantageous to them politically, you know, change their mind. There's an honesty to it that I appreciate. I would actually be very suspicious of a leader who is hopelessly resistant to changing her mind or changing his mind on any given issue. Like there are matters of principle. I understand that. But there are also matters of learning, matters of information, matters of evolution.
It is a pleasure to have you in the bookcase.
Sure was.
Oh, you're very kind.
And if you'd be so kind to stand by, we've got some rapid fire questions for you after this.
Absolutely.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer.
We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Carlos, some rapid-fire questions. A newspaper, hard copy or digital?
Hard copy on Sundays, digital during the week.
First section of the paper that you read?
Page one.
Okay.
You know what? The book review. I scanned the book review followed by page one.
When you go on vacation, what books do you bring? Do you have guilty pleasures? Like, when you go on vacation, is it nothing but dirty rom-coms? Come on, Carlos, tell us.
It's incredibly stressful for me to decide what I'm going to be taking to that one week at the beach in August, right? And all year, I know this is not rapid fire, sorry, but throughout the year, I have this like stack of books that I'm adding to and subtracting from and looking at, like, which books do I want to take? Because, you know, I can only take maybe three or four, and God knows that I can't just be like about them at the end. Like, I have to really like them because I don't get to read very much. So, for instance, last summer it was Heartburn. It was also Flannery O'Connor's debut novel, Wise Blood, which was amazing.
Guilty pleasure in the newspaper. Is it a crossword, Wordle, Sudoku, connections, jumble, comics, recipes, gossip? What is it?
I'm going to blame my kids for getting me into comics. Canderville is one of my favorite comics that I look for in the Sunday Washington Post. And I hate to say it, Spelling Bee and Wordle helped me wake up.
What do you love most about Washington?
Oh, God. Walking around. I think Washington's a beautiful city, like physically. And I love walking around Washington.
What do you hate most about Washington?
That everyone hates Washington.
I don't know why my father put this on a list of rapid fire questions, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Has the internet had a beneficial effect on news or diminished it?
It has had a proliferating effect. Whether it's beneficial, it's too early to tell.
Last book you purchased, and did you pay retail?
Last book I purchased. I do. I purchase most of my books when I purchase books at Politics and Prose. I don't purchase many because the one fringe benefit of my job is that I can request almost any book. I just purchased a book about, let's see, The Country of the Blind, a memoir at the end of sight by Andrew Leland, which I've heard great things about.
When you write a column, do you think I need to put something funny in here? Because many of your columns have wonderful bits of humor.
Thank you for that. I don't feel that I need to. I feel that, I mean, sometimes, like I said, you know, you look for a moment where a column can use, a little levity or just a beat, just a breath, something. But usually it's just like, if it happens to come to me, then in it goes, right? There was a moment in my essay on Barack Obama's A Promised Land where I felt he was using a lot of kind of political cliches, and it just came to me, and I put it in a parenthetical. I said, it's the audacity of trope. And that's the, and I swear that is the one line that people remember from that piece, you know? It's like, oh, audacity of trope, that was great, you know?
I'd forgotten that, yes. Well, Carlos, it is a pleasure to have you in the bookcase. The Washington Book is the name of this one. It does not belong in the section of the bookstore of Washington Books. because it is an exception to the rule. It is a compendium of his columns. I'm always suspicious of books that are compendiums of columns, but this one holds up, and it is a very, very enjoyable reading, even if he has to go through the difficult task of reading all the books that come out on Washington. Pleasure to have you with us. Thank you very much.
Indeed.
Thank you so much.
Carlos Lozada, who is a sort of an all-purpose insulter, an equal opportunity insulter of politicians and their books, and the fact that they have to write them, they feel they have to write them when they're running for office. Ex-presidents, with the exception, as he said, of George H.W. Bush, tend to write them after they get out of the White House. I found his observation that he found books by ex-presidents that weren't about their presidency to be the most illustrative of their character and the better of the books. I think he said that in the case of Jimmy Carter. In the case of, I forgot.
In the case of Grant and in the case of Obama, who The Dreams of My Father was his best book. That really stays with me from this conversation for sure. And then the other thing that really struck me is when he's talking about how many political books out there, how many politicians that were flashes in the pan that we thought were going to be huge that ended up writing one, two books that are in the warehouses. Like, how many warehouses of lost political candidate books are there in the ether?
He talked about Scott Walker when he was a hot property and people thought maybe he was going to get higher office. Maybe the book sold a few copies in Wisconsin from whence Walker came. But I don't remember that that book was necessarily a hot property. And I suspect there are many copies of it sitting back in the warehouse.
Exactly. There's probably a Dukakis book. There's probably, the list goes on. I just was thinking about how many dusty tomes. Carlos Lozada, a great conversation. We recommend picking up this book. It's a really great read.
As I mentioned, I'm normally suspicious of books that are, you know, collections of past columns written by somebody. Often they don't stand up to time, in my estimation, but his thesis is so intriguing that these authors reveal something of themselves in the books that I certainly wanted to read it, liked it, and we do. We recommend it. The Washington Book, How to Read Politics and Politicians. We'll remind you of the folks who put this podcast to bed each week and also get a coda from Carlos Lozada.
The Bookcase is a production of ABC Audio in partnership with Good Morning America. It is produced by David Canada in conjunction with SureCam Productions. Asal Essanapour is our producer. Laura Mayer and Simone Swink are our executive producers. We give special thanks to Taylor Rhodes, Amanda McMaster, and Sarah Russell of Good Morning America, and Josh Cohan, Nania McLean, Vika Aronson, and Brenda Salinas Baker at ABC Audio.
Because of the nature of my job and what people think book critic means, people always ask me what they should read, right? And I always say, like, I don't know, you know, I don't know you. I don't know your interests or your blind spots or, you know, your fascinations. But what I usually encourage people to do, and I would encourage your listeners to do, instead of reading something new, I would reread a book that meant something to you. There are many books I want to read, but more than that, there's books that I want to reread and experience once again. So that's my advice to all the people preemptively who ask me what they should be reading. I push it back on them and just say, pick something to reread.